I did more than 105 interviews over 7 years for this book. And in each case, each technology I talk about, I talk to lots of different kinds of people. So developers of the tools, policymakers, frontline caseworkers. But in each story, I started with folks who are most directly affected by the tools, folks who are looking for public assistance, who are involved in the child welfare system, who are unhoused or homeless. And it's too rare that we hear the voices of people who are actually directly affected, particularly when we talk about these new technologies. I'm here to talk about what I describe in the book as a digital poorhouse, which is a sort of invisible institution that's made up of decision-making algorithms, automated eligibility processes, and statistical models, particularly predictive models, in the U.S. social service programs. So I want to talk today about how the rise of this invisible institution is sunk into the policy history of the United States, and how it responds and recreates specifically a narrative of austerity. This idea, this false idea, that there's not enough for everyone, and that we have to make hard decisions about who deserves to access their basic human needs and who does not. So we often talk about the kinds of tools that I write about in the book as disruptors, but they're really more evolution than revolution. And their roots go very, very deep in U.S. history, and specifically to a moment in the early 1800s where we decided to sort of invent a new technology for managing poverty, which was in the U.S. context, the county poorhouse. But I think it's really important that we contextualize these tools that get talked about as if they sort of appeared from nowhere, like the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Their roots are really deep in our respective histories. So I'm just going to talk about one of these historical moments briefly, which is in 1819, we had a really horrible economic depression in the United States, one that was accompanied by a lot of organizing by poor and working class people for their rights and their survival. And this, of course, made economic elites really, really nervous. They did what economic elites always do when they get really nervous, and they commissioned a whole bunch of studies. And so the studies, that line never gets a laugh in academic talks, by the way. So they frame the question behind all these studies. What's the real problem during this catastrophic economic recession? Is it poverty? Is it lack of access to resources? Or is it what they called at the time pauperism, which was dependence on public benefits? So how do you think the studies came back? Was it actual poverty or was it pauperism? Yes, you're very smart people. This is exactly what the studies came back and said. The problem is when we're too generous, allowing people not to starve through this economic depression, they become dependent on public benefits, they lose their work ethic, they have a bunch of babies and get drunk. So they invented this new technology, honestly, that was imported from England, which was our version of the workhouse. It's called the county poorhouse. And this was basically a brick and mortar institution for more or less incarcerating people who asked for support from public funds. So they were strictly voluntary in the sense that homeless shelters are strictly voluntary, although you could be sentenced to the poorhouse for crimes like vagrancy, having nowhere to live, begging, asking for help, or prostitution, which at the time meant having sex while not being married. So you could get sentenced to the poorhouse, but for folks who voluntarily entered, it was not an easy decision. It was 1819, so not everybody had these rights, but if you had the right to vote and hold office, you had to give it up in order to enter the poorhouse. You couldn't marry when you were in the poorhouse. You were often separated from your children because it was understood that poor and working class children could be redeemed by having more contact with richer families, and by contact they generally meant labor as domestic or agricultural workers. And some of these institutions, one of the most notorious being Tewkesbury in Massachusetts, had death rates as high as 30% a year. Basically, a third of people entering died every year. So the reason that I use this as sort of the origin story I tell about the digital poorhouse is because it's a moment that the United States made two really important decisions. The first was that the first and most important thing our social service system could do is a kind of moral diagnosis, deciding who deserves help and who doesn't, who's deserving and who is undeserving, rather than, say, building a system that created a universal floor under everyone. And the second thing we decided at that moment was that it was acceptable and appropriate to ask people to give up one of their basic human rights for another, right? So their right to their children or their right to vote for their right to things like food and shelter. And this is what I think of as sort of the deep social programming that underlies the new tools that we're seeing in social services. For the sort of techies in the room, that would be the legacy programming on which the rest of the tool is built. I want us to think a little bit together today about this political moment, about why these specific tools have become popular at this precise time. And I think there's three reasons for that. The first is these new tools rationalize and recreate a politics of austerity, the idea that there's not enough for everyone. Second, they purport to address bias in these systems, but in fact, they often hide or displace the bias to a new place. And third, at their worst, they create a kind of empathy override that allows us to ease the emotional burden of making what I think are inhumanly difficult decisions. Decisions like who gets access to emergency shelter and who is forced to live on the street in a tent or in a car. I dedicate this book to a little girl named Sophie Stipes, a severely disabled little girl who, when she was six, received a letter from the state of Indiana that explained that she would be losing her Medicaid, which is the health care insurance program for poor and working families in the United States, because she had failed to cooperate in establishing eligibility for the program. So this was happening just as she was gaining weight, really on par with normal patterns for the first time in her life. She had just had a gastrointestinal feeding tube implanted, and she was learning to walk for the first time. So her family was caught up in an attempt by the state of Indiana to automate and modernize and privatize all of the eligibility functions for the state's welfare program. So that's Medicaid, that health insurance program I was talking about, cash assistance, which in the U.S. is called TANF, and food stamps, a program's now called SNAP, but at the time was called food stamps. So in 2006, the governor of the state at the time, Mitch Daniels, signed what was eventually a $1.34 billion contract with a consortium of companies, including IBM and Affiliated Computer Services, or ACS, now owned by Xerox, to create a system that basically replaced the work of local county caseworkers with online forms and regional call centers. And what that looked like from a caseworker's point of view was, in the past, they had been responsible for a docket of families, or a caseload, which were individuals and families that they often developed relationships with over time and helped them navigate the really difficult, complex, and punitive social service system. Instead, they were now moved to regionalized call centers, often hundreds of miles away from where they lived, and responded, rather than to a docket of families, to a sort of a list of tasks that dropped into their electronic workflow management system. So for caseworkers, this felt very much like they were not able to develop relationships with people over time, because every call just went to the next available worker. It felt like their local knowledge was no longer useful. So they could say, like, well, it looks like you're not going to be eligible for food stamps. But they couldn't then say, but there's a food pantry in your town. It's open Tuesday nights. So they felt like it really changed the nature of their job. From applicants' point of view, it felt like if anything went wrong in this process, because it was so difficult to talk to the same person more than once, that basically all the responsibility for finding out what had gone wrong and fixing it fell on families themselves, which are some of the most vulnerable families in the state. And the result was a million benefits denials in the first 3 years of the experiment. It was a 54% increase from the 3 years before the experiment. And almost all of them were denied for this catch-all reason that was in Sophie Stipes' letter, failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. The second tool I want to talk about today is a tool called the Allegheny Family Screening Tool, the AFST. And the Allegheny Family Screening Tool is a statistical model that's supposed to be able to predict which children might be victims of abuse or neglect in the future in Allegheny County, which is the county where Pittsburgh is in Pennsylvania. So let me introduce you to a family. I want to introduce you to Angel and Patrick, Angel Shepherd and Patrick Grebe. So I met them at this sort of community hub where families gather to like share resources, connect with each other, do peer support, that kind of stuff. And Angel and Patrick didn't stand out right away because their experience really was so average. It was so characteristic of what I see as the routine, mundane indignities that are suffered by the white working class in the United States. So they've struggled with low-wage, dangerous work, poor-quality public schools and predatory online education, poor health and community violence. But through it all, they've been creative, involved parents. So I describe Patrick in the book as kind of a Buddhist ex-biker, right? So he's this enormous rectangle, like refrigerator-sized man who has like really elaborate facial hair, and he's really calm. He's like deeply calm. And Angel and Patrick are caring for two young girls, or helping to care for two young girls, Angel's daughter, Harriet, and Patrick's daughter's daughter, Desiree. And the two girls are roughly the same age, so they bicker a lot. They fight a lot. So Angel and Patrick's solution for this is what they call the get-along shirt. And the get-along shirt is one of Patrick's like enormous button-down shirts. And they take both girls and they put them in the shirt, one arm through one armhole, one arm in the waist of the other girl, and they button the shirt back up. And you're not allowed to leave the get-along shirt until you stop fighting, even if you have to go to the bathroom. And this is the thing that Patrick said always works. As soon as someone has to pee, the fighting stops because no one wants to pee in the get-along shirt. So despite this, Angel and Patrick have racked up sort of a lifetime of interactions with the child welfare system in Allegheny County, which is called Children, Youth, and Family Services, or CYF. So Patrick was investigated for medical neglect in the early 2000s because he was unable to afford his daughter Tabitha's antibiotic prescription after a visit to the emergency room. So he brought her to the emergency room because she was sick. They prescribed antibiotics. He couldn't afford to fill the prescription. She got worse. He brought her back. The nurse said, oh, we saw you before. We know you didn't fill the prescription. And they reported them for child neglect, for medical neglect. When Harriet, Angel's daughter, was five, someone phoned a string of reports to the county's child abuse and neglect hotline. So it's possible to be anonymous on these hotlines. So this sort of anonymous tipster explained that Harriet was running around the neighborhood unsupervised, that she was down the block teasing a dog, that she wasn't being properly clothed, fed, or bathed, that she wasn't getting needed medication. So for each call, an investigator from CYF came out to the house, interviewed Harriet and Tabitha, Angel and Patrick, looked in all their cupboards and under all their beds, and requested access to the family's medical records. And then each time, they found no evidence of maltreatment, so they closed the case. But the record of these cases is now kept in digital form and maintained on an integrated data warehouse that was built by the county in 1999, which feeds the Allegheny Family Screening Tool. So the system in Allegheny County sort of began in 1999 when the county built this integrated data warehouse that gets regular data extracts from about 30 different agencies around the county and around the state. So as of the writing of the book, that integrated data warehouse held about a billion records, which was more than 800 for every individual living in Allegheny County. But it doesn't actually collect data equally on everyone living in the county. In fact, the way that public services works in the U.S., it really only collects information about poor and working families. So, for example, if you're struggling with an addiction or recovery issue and you're a professional middle class family, you would go to your family doctor. That would be, they might refer you to addiction recovery. That would be covered by employer-provided private insurance, and that information would not go into this database. If you're a poor and working class family, you'd rely on county services for those recovery services, and that data would go into the database. If you are a professional middle class family and you need just some like respite in your parenting, you might get a nanny or pay for a babysitter and you'll pay out of pocket. If you are a poor and working class person and you need daycare when you go to work, you're going to get that from a county-based daycare provider, and that information will go into the database. So the parents that I spoke to about this system said that it felt like it confused parenting while poor with poor parenting. They were really concerned with what are known as false positives. So this system that pulls variables from that data warehouse and runs an algorithm to create a risk score, parents, as you might imagine, were really concerned that it would predict harm where no harm was actually occurring. So that's a false positives problem. But I also spent a whole day sitting in the call center with intake screeners. They're the folks who get the calls from the county hotline or who get reports from mandated reporters and make this really difficult decision about which ones to screen in for full investigations and which ones to screen out. Keep the data, but not investigate right now. And call screeners were worried about the same problem, but from the opposite perspective. They were concerned about false negatives. Because the system has almost no data on professional middle-class families, they were concerned that the system would not be able to recognize the kind of or predict the kind of harm that actually might be happening in professional middle-class families. So, for example, there's good data in the United States that geographic isolation is correlated with maltreatment, but those folks won't end up in the data warehouse, so that kind of harm won't be recognized and they won't be able to predict it. So one of the things that's interesting about this system is the designers of the system will say that one of the reasons they built it is to identify and intervene in racial disproportionality in the system. In the United States, 47 of 50 states pull Black, biracial, and Native American children out of their families and put them into foster care at rates that far exceed their proportion in the population. So that's known as racial disproportionality. So the designers of the system say, we don't know that this system necessarily will solve racial disproportionality, but we believe with better data, we can identify discriminatory decision-making in the system and we can step in. Now, what's really interesting is that the county's own data shows that intake screening, the point at which this tool is aimed, is not actually the place where racial disproportionality is entering the system. It actually enters at what's known as call referral, which is when people call on families to these hotlines or report them through mandated reporting processes. So in Allegheny County, Black and biracial families are 350% more likely to be reported to child welfare services by the community. Once those cases get in the system, there is a little bit of disproportionality that's added at call screening. So call screeners screen in 69% of cases around Black and biracial children and only 65% of cases around white children. But that's a 4% difference versus a 350% difference. And I think that's something that's really interesting around these systems, and it behooves us to pay really close attention when designers of these tools talk about them as tools for increasing racial equity. I think we should be really cautious when folks start making those arguments. Because what I saw in Allegheny County was a very sophisticated tool, a very resource-intensive and sophisticated tool aimed at the place where the problem wasn't happening. And at worst, it could actually remove some human discretion from the front line of that system, these intake call screeners, who are, by the way, the most racially diverse, the most working class, and the most female part of their workforce. And removing their discretion could very much create actually amplification of the kind of discrimination that's entering the system at call referral. So one of the questions I try to leave people with in the book is to say we shouldn't be asking discretion yes or no. We should be asking discretion who. Because I have this very smart political science friend named Joe Soss, and he said discretion is like energy. It can never be created or destroyed. It's only ever moved. So in this case, they're actually moving the discretion from the front line of their workers and giving it to the economists and data scientists and computer programmers who are developing the system.